Jennifer vanished sometime in the overnight hours.
Right now, there is no trace.
Investigators say evidence leads them to believe that she's dead.
Stick my nose back in the trail. That's all I can do.
This is already gone.
Already gone.
Already gone.
Hey, friends. Already Gone is celebrating 8 years of production this month, so I thought I would mark the occasion with a bonus episode, something short and sweet and reminiscent of our early days. This week, we're looking at two older cases from Oakland County, Michigan. These two cases are resolved, but mostly lost to history. There isn't enough information for each to have their own episode, so I've gathered them here to share with you. One is from the 1960s and the other from the 1980s. In their day, each case was a headline grabber, but now you'd be hard-pressed to find much about them online. Covering true crime for almost a decade, I've come across a handful of cases where a youthful offender, someone under 18, is sentenced to life in prison for their crimes. In the last few years, the state of Michigan has taken a look at the hundreds of minors sentenced to life without parole and reviewed their cases. They wanted to see if the life sentence should be revisited and perhaps updated to allow for the possibility of parole at some point. In February of 2021, we covered the 1990 murder of 15-year-old Stephanie DeBay. The two people involved in her death and dismemberment were 21-year-old Jamie Rodriguez Jr. and 15-year-old Augustus Pena. Both were sentenced to life without parole. In December of 2021, Pena walked free. He had spent almost 30 years behind bars for his role in DeBay's murder. Having his case reviewed meant that Pena, who was never a problem prisoner, was eligible for release. According to a story in the Macomb Daily, Pena was a mentor to young inmates and taught several classes. At the time of the murder, 15-year-old Pena was living with Rodriguez and had little support from his immediate family. But what if the people you kill are that immediate family? You know, the ones that are supposed to be your support? What if you, a 14-year-old boy, take a shotgun to your parents and kid sister? That's the case we're discussing today, the actions of 14-year-old Brandon Carnell, who on Wednesday, June 22, 1988, murdered his mother, father, and younger sister. He reloaded the shotgun between blasts. Unlike Pena, who had little support from his parents, Brandon lived with his mom, dad, and 11-year-old sister, Candace. The family made their home in Springfield Township, a little town in North Oakland County, halfway between Lake Orion and Fenton. According to a story in the Detroit News, Brandon's father, Michael Carnell, worked at General Motors Truck and Coach in Pontiac as a computer operator. Brandon's mother, Carol, once worked at Pontiac General Hospital, but was more recently employed as a makeup artist. The family of four was very active in their church, attending services regularly at Dixie Baptist Church in Clarkston. The children attended the church's school, Springfield Christian Academy. The church's pastor, Reverend Paul Vanneman, told the press that Michael and Carol met at the church and were married in the church. In fact, two of his own children were attendants in their wedding. The Carnell family murders hit very close to home for the Reverend. One of the first people on scene at the shooting was a deputy from the Oakland County Sheriff's Department. Sergeant Anthony Valet would eventually testify that Brandon reported that his family had been shot during a robbery. Brandon's initial claim when approached by police was that someone broke into the home, shooting his family. Valet challenged Brandon, telling him that he didn't believe his story. He encouraged him to tell the truth. Brandon expressed concern about the electric chair. Valet was understanding, telling Brandon that no one would hurt him and no one would abuse or beat him. Valet testified that Brandon told him that his mother picked on him. He was, quote, slapped around and humiliated. Brandon would reveal in other interviews that issues with his mother had been building for a long time. Finally, he admitted to Valet that there was no break-in. Brandon, for whatever reason, had reached his limit in the relationship he had with his mother. This led to him firing one shot each into the back of his mother and the back of his sister. Then he waited for his father to get home from work, and when he arrived, Brandon shot him twice. Once Brandon had murdered his family, he disposed of the weapon by throwing it into a nearby pond where it was later recovered. After being taken into custody, Brandon Carnell was transported to Children's Village in Pontiac, where he was held and received some psychiatric evaluation and treatment. Brandon's case was picked up by noted Detroit area defense attorney Mitchell Ribiter. Ribiter told the press that Carnell, quote, definitely suffered physical and emotional abuse from his parents and has been, quote, very disturbed by what happened. Because of Brandon's age, 14 at the time of the shooting, laws in Michigan stated that he could not be tried as an adult. After consulting with counsel on Wednesday, November 23, 1988, the day before Thanksgiving, Brandon entered a guilty plea to the charges against him. In news coverage of the plea, his attorney said that Brandon is remorseful and he's going to get therapy and become a productive citizen. According to a December 1988 story in the Detroit Free Press, Oakland County Probate Court Judge Sandra Silver recommended that Brandon remain in custody until age 19. Upon hearing this recommendation, Brandon's legal team was hopeful that he could be released in as little as 18 months. June 22, 1989, marked the one-year anniversary of the murders. Brandon spent the day, as he always did, residing at the now-defunct W.J. Maxey Training School in Whitmore Lake, where he was being rehabilitated. The Carnell case went quiet until 1992, when there was a small story in the Free Press titled, Teen Who Killed Parents, Sister, Likely to Be Freed. The article explained that Brandon Carnell, who once shot his family to death, would likely be released from custody around the time of his 19th birthday. This meant he could be released around the end of November, 1992. While Brandon was in custody, Michigan law changed, allowing minors convicted of serious crimes to be held until age 21. The Oakland County prosecutor looked to have that ruling retroactively applied to the Carnell case, but his efforts were unsuccessful. While it was not the 18 months that one of his attorneys predicted, Brandon Carnell walked free at the end of November, 1992. He was 19 years old and had spent almost 5 full years in custody. And that, dear listeners, is where the story ends. A 19-year-old Brandon Carnell was released from the now-closed Maxey Training Center, and someone supported him as he transitioned back into society. From my research, I believe that Brandon is still living in the Detroit area. While there is very little available on his case, what I shared with you was mainly pulled from news archives. I don't know why the Carnell family murder has faded from memory while other cases still capture our imagination. I was surprised when I came across this story while browsing Reddit on a rainy afternoon in January. Before we get to part two of our episode, let's hear from this week's sponsor. Before we begin, I want to thank Jane for suggesting this case. Not only was it a story I'd never heard of, it reignited memories from my childhood. This one takes me back to elementary school, to a summer camp I attended, and it takes me back to my old neighborhood. This murder is long forgotten, but it is worth remembering and revisiting. We'll start at Kimball High School. I know, it's not Kimball High School anymore, it's Royal Oak High School. But in the 80s, it was Kimball. And while I was never a student there, I attended several Kimball Knights football games and even went to Kimball's prom. Across the street from Kimball is John Lindell Arena, which is where my hockey career started. Lindell was my home ice for 2 or 3 years before our team moved to a different rink. Finally, we have to talk about Quickstad Park. If you'd asked me before Jane sent me the message if I knew where Quickstad Park was, I would have said I'd never heard of it. But a consultation with Google Maps refreshed my memory. Quickstad, where I attended summer camp 1 year in the early 80s, is located right behind the Kimball Athletic Fields. It's about a block from the ice arena. I'm pretty sure that teenage me got up to shenanigans in Quickstead Park on more than one occasion. But anyway, the story takes place in Royal Oak, Michigan, on the north end of town. Our victim, David Giroudeau, lived on Windermere in Royal Oak. My home for the middle part of the 80s was two houses off of Windermere, but in Madison Heights, about a mile from where the Giroudeau family lived. The year was 1967. David Giroudeau, age 4, was the baby of the family. His dad, John, was a sergeant with the Royal Oak Fire Department, and his mom, Betty, was a homemaker, and she was responsible for the other children, Karen, John, Larry, and James. Betty and David had grown up in the Thumb area of Michigan and relocated to the Detroit area for work sometime in the 1950s. Now, it's the end of October, 1967, and local kids are excited about Halloween. On October 30th, David and his mother went to a friend's house. David's mother was friends with Mrs. Wingle, and little David would play with her daughter, 3-year-old Nancy. Mrs. Bittinger from down the block joined the mothers. While the women were enjoying a coffee in the house, the children played in the yard. At one point, little Nancy came into the house and informed the women that a big boy on a bicycle invited David to the park to look for snakes. The park she was referring to was Quickstead Park, the 3-acre wooded area behind the high school. The women were stunned, but only for a moment. One of them ran to the phone and dialed the police, and the other women raced toward the park, calling David's name. It's 2:37 p.m. When police arrived at the park, they enlisted some of the high school boys to help them search for the missing 4-year-old. It was high schooler Joseph Schwartz who found David's body. He found him near a footpath at the western edge of the park. And I want to note that a Daily Tribune news article from 1967 describes the park as 31 acres, but a look at the website for the park says it's about 2.5 acres in size. I believe the 2.5 acre size is likely the more accurate measurement of the space. Little David had been strangled, his body left in a pile. News reports state there was no sign of molestation. Now, Nancy Wingle, the 3-year-old who'd been playing with David when he was taken by the boy on the bicycle, Nancy had a sharp eye. She gave a description of the person who took her friend. It was Officer Thomas Price who spotted a teenager on a bicycle who matched the description. He called out to the boy to stop, but the young man kept pedaling away. Price called out again, and when the teen didn't stop this time, Price drew his weapon and announced, "Stop, or I will shoot." At least, that's what was reported in the Daily Tribune. The Detroit News credited Officer Patrick Patton with apprehending the youth. When Royal Oak officers spoke to the teen on the bike, he had a chain wrapped around one hand. He told police that the little boy was in the woods. The boy on the bike was 15-year-old Dennis J.G. Leonard, a student at Kimball High School, and he was immediately taken into custody. I was very curious about Leonard and his interactions with law enforcement in the court system. Unfortunately, aside from a page or two in the police report on this incident, there isn't much available. Once in custody, Leonard told police that he took David into the woods of the park, under the pretense that they would look for snakes. Once in the woods, he asked David to lie down, and the child refused. So Leonard, quote, pushed him down a little bit. Then Leonard pinned him to the ground with his own body. Leonard wrapped the chain around his neck and pulled. David struggled and fought for his life. When the little boy stopped struggling, Leonard walked away, returning to his bicycle. A Detective Martin asked Leonard if he thought the child was dead, and Leonard replied, "No, I don't think so." Leonard could provide investigators with no reason for the attack, but he did confess to an earlier attack on a 5-year-old where he choked the child by putting his arm around his neck. He was not even on police radar for that assault. Around 6 o'clock, Dennis Leonard's attorney, Harry Dell, was called to the police station. The Oakland County prosecutor was also notified, and prosecutor Jack Bain arrived soon after. Dennis Leonard was read his rights and repeated the story he told earlier. Police and Leonard's attorney thought it would be a good idea if a priest came to the station to talk with Leonard. A priest arrived soon after to talk to the teenager about the events of that afternoon. Now, I find it interesting that the name of the priest and their parish was redacted from the section of the police file that I had access to. After talking to the priest, Leonard was taken to Children's Village. Young David's remains were taken to the Siller Spittler Funeral Home in Royal Oak. In the weeks following the death of young David Giraudeau, there was a lot of talk in the community about what should happen to the park. Some people wanted it cleared out to make it safer. Others felt that patrols of the area should be stepped up. Eventually, the saga involving the fate of the park fell out of the press. The story of Dennis Leonard also disappeared. I was unable to determine what became of him, although I'm assuming he ended up serving time, likely in a juvenile facility. Little David is buried at Mount Olivet Cemetery in the city of Detroit. I'm Nina Instead, the writer, producer, and voice behind the Already Gone podcast. I appreciate you listening, and please, be safe.